Good afternoon. This is Chris Blazewski with the New York Times Sports Sunday for Sunday, November 10th, 2019, here on WRRS Radio Reading Service. And the main story in today's New York Times Sports section is by Joe Drape and Ken Belson, and it's headlined, America's Game Makes Its Case. On a December morning in 2017, some of the most powerful men in football gathered at a Midtown hotel in New York with a vital mission to save their sport. Robert K. Kraft, owner of the New England Patriots, was there, as was the commissioner of the NFL, Roger Goodell. Commissioners from the Power Five college athletic conferences were in the room. So were Northwestern's head coach, Pat Fitzgerald, and a pair of Hall of Famers turned business titans, Roger Staubach and Archie Manning. That these men felt compelled to turn the gathering, an annual meeting of the National Football Foundation, into a strategy session for pushing back against the forces threatening their game illustrates the dramatic disruption football has undergone in the past decade. Over that time, the public's awareness of football's role in some forms of long-term brain damage has potentially become the sport's kryptonite. There was no table pounding, no hand-wringing, but there was a sense of urgency. If we stand for anything, it's to protect the game. So let's step off the curb and get to work, said Stephen Hatchell, the foundation's chief executive, summing up the mood in the room that day. Football remains, far and away, the country's most popular sport. It garners huge television audiences every week, and more children play it than they do any other sport. But participation in youth leagues is dropping. Over the last decade, the number of high school boys playing tackle football, the heart and soul of the sport, has dropped more than 10%. The people who play the game are changing too, with the number of white players diminishing as black and Hispanic players increasingly make up a larger plurality of the player pool. Harder to measure is how fans perceive the game, but clearly football has become yet another thing that people are for or against. Several states are considering whether young people should even play the tackle version of the sport at all, as they weigh legislation to impose minimum age requirements for playing. As research on the damage football causes to young athletes grows and stories about the diminished capabilities of former NFL greats continue to be a vital part of the sports conversation, some parents have come to fear that they may be putting their children in danger by letting them play football. Those forces make securing the future of the sport a substantial challenge. Football participation is down even in places you would not expect, while soccer and cross-country running have grown significantly. In Texas, that state that gave us $70 million high school stadiums and Friday night lights, football is down 10%. Ohio has produced the fourth highest total of NFL players. Participation has dropped 27% in the Buckeye State. Eight Ohio high schools were unable to fill squads to play even eight-man football last year. Kansas, stricken with budget cuts, is down 13%. With participation declining, expensive football programs have become an easy target for school boards looking to save money. The state also now has 12 schools playing six-man football. It's impossible to nail down one reason for the decline. Specialization has hurt all sports, as has the growth of video games and esports. It is also impossible, however, to ignore the impact of health and safety, especially when it comes to brain injuries. Not only are high school boys almost twice as likely to sustain a head injury in football during a game compared with the next closest sport, but they are more likely to get a head injury in football than any other injury in any other sport recorded in the National High School Sports-Related Injury Surveillance Study. This is how Kane Hauser, the athletic director at Maiden High School in North Carolina, in the heart of a breeding ground for many top college programs, summed up the psyche that his staff has to battle. Parents are scared of head injuries, and rightly so. The New York Times commissioned a national online poll of 1,000 14 to 17-year-old boys. The survey conducted by Pollfish this fall found 9% of those who identified themselves as football players said they had parents who voiced concerns over head injuries, compared with 3% of wrestlers and 2% of hockey players. Still, only 4% of boys said that personal concerns over head injuries were the main reason they quit. A third of former players said they just lost interest. Another third became busy with something else, and 15% said they simply started playing another sport. Hauser said the number of players on the Maiden varsity football team had fallen to 30 from 41 since 2013. The decline, he said, is worse in neighboring districts where junior varsity teams have been shuttered. Parents are steering their children into sports they can play year-round, like baseball and basketball, to give them a leg up on making a college team. Although coaches have tried to address their concerns by teaching new tackling techniques and monitoring head injuries closely, Hauser said it could be very hard when parents get caught up in the "let's don't take a chance" thing. The headwinds are real, but football is still operating from a position of strength. In 2018, for example, 9 of the top 10 most watched primetime broadcasts were NFL or college football games. Football's golden age may be behind it, but whether it is in a slow fade, on the verge of a renaissance, or heading for a collapse is a matter of debate. In the coming weeks, the Times will examine football's hold on America among children and their parents in the heartland, at public high schools and elite colleges. A significant decline in football's prominence would represent an important cultural shift in America. The sport long ago surpassed baseball as the true national pastime, both in terms of participation and fanaticism. And seeing its numbers drop represents a chance to understand in real time how quickly the ground can shift. In the middle of the 20th century, boxing and horse racing ruled, then suddenly did not. Few understood or explored the dynamics. Safety concerns were growing, and entertainment options were increasing while they were underway. Certainly, the 30 or so National Football Foundation board members in the room that morning, 2 Decembers ago, understood that they had to try to change the narrative surrounding their game. All were volunteers. All were there on their own dime. Most had played the game and credited the lessons they learned on the field for their success. They were savvy business people, and many were invested in keeping the sport a multi-billion dollar industry at the top of the nation's entertainment pyramid. The organization was founded in 1947 when football was ascendant by a war hero, a coach, and a sports writer. General Douglas MacArthur, Army's coach Red Blake, and Grantland Rice of the New York Herald Tribune. They wanted to make sure football inhabited a sacred place in the American psyche. Its mission was straightforward: to promote football as a way to mold future leaders through sportsmanship, competition, and academic excellence. By the time the December 2017 meeting had ended, football's power brokers had decided to try to make that mission relevant in the 21st century. Within weeks, money started to roll in. Kraft and Jerry Jones, owner of the Dallas Cowboys and a foundation board member, along with Goodell on behalf of the NFL, came up with several $100,000. The NCAA commissioners pledged to set aside money from the college football playoff. Several doctors offered their counsel, including those skeptical of research linking repeated head hits to degenerative brain disease. Practically overnight, rebranding football became perhaps the biggest part of the foundation's portfolio, next to maintaining the College Football Hall of Fame and honoring the academic achievements of collegiate football players. By 2018, the campaign #FootballMatters had begun to spread across multiple platforms. On the Football Matters website, there were resources for parents on rule changes and safety advances. articles about leadership and teamwork and overcoming adversity, and football-friendly data, such as the number of colleges that field football teams, 775, with seven more being added by 2022, and the number of college players who are working on their master's degree, 1,439 out of about 73,000. Each Friday, fans who connect with Football Matters on social media get hype videos of high school coaches' pregame talks to their teams. For casual fans, there was a documentary about Polynesian football or a YouTube video of a girls' tackle football league in Utah. The five-year campaign has cost $2 million so far. The foundation's leaders say they have been careful not to allow the NFL and the NCAA or their largesse to take the lead in a campaign aimed at everyday people. Is it working? It's too early to tell. Television ratings are rebounding after a period of decline, but participation has continued to fall. We're not going to change anyone's minds, but we hope to put football in a fuller context and give people enough information to make their own decisions, said Ken Luce, the founding partner of LDWW, the marketing agency based in Dallas that is running the campaign. Others in the sport who want to maintain football's prominence have redoubled their efforts to build a better helmet, but the structure of the human head, hard skull, soft brain makes that challenging. Pop Warner is pushing the idea that tackling can be safer, though many neuroscientists are skeptical. Teams and coaches at every level are decreasing the number of contact practices because scientists increasingly warn of the risks of not just concussions, but repeated head and body hits. No one knows how much is too much. We are facing a lot of issues. The biggest one is that you can get hurt playing football, said Hatchell, the foundation's chief executive. But we have decided to be a player in the conversation, to push back. Hatchell concedes that the foundation and all the game's boosters need to be nimble and aggressive in telling people that their game is changing for the better. It's still the most popular sport out there, Hatchell said. So how do we continue to build on it? And in the coming weeks, the New York Times will continue this series on examining football's hold on America. But now turning to the sport the rest of the world calls football, but the United States calls soccer. This is the column by Rory Smith, and it's headlined, "There all will always be an England, but it's changing." And of course, it's datelined in the country that invented the sport, specifically Rochdale, England. Alfie McClellan was grumbling as he walked out of the low-slung, lopsided stadium that his team, Rochdale, calls home. It was not so much that Rochdale had lost that bothered McClellan. Rochdale fans like him know, from long experience, not to expect to win, especially not when playing a team like Ipswich Town, arguably the best team in League One, English soccer's third tier. No, what concerned McClellan was the manner of the defeat. "We were just slogging it forward," he explained to a friend. As it chased the game, he felt Rochdale had done what teams at this level have done for years. Played the sort of direct, muscular soccer that passes for a traditional English style. "That's not a game plan," McClellan said. "We don't need to play like that." As evidence, he cites a goal Rochdale scored against Southend earlier this season. A sweeping move spanning the length of the field, 16 passes in all, before the forward Ian Henderson tapped the ball home. It was a mesmerizing sequence, especially for League One. But though Henderson was invited onto national radio a couple of days later to discuss Rochdale's transformation into a Milltown Barcelona, he did not receive all the credit. Nor did his teammates or even his manager. Instead, when a clip of the goal went viral on social media, it was in tribute to someone who, most likely, had never seen Rochdale play, Pep Guardiola. Together with Jurgen Klopp, the Liverpool manager, Guardiola has helped transform the Premier League over the last 3 years. It is hard to dispute as Guardiola's Manchester City prepares to face Klopp's Liverpool at Anfield on Sunday that the best two teams in England are now the best two teams in the world. Increasingly, though, it has become an orthodoxy that they have transformed more than just their teams and their league. There is a sense that Guardiola's ideas, in particular, have resonated far beyond the Etihad Stadium. It has been credited with inspiring a cultural shift across English soccer, one that has encouraged even the likes of Rochdale to envisage a style based on more than slogging it forward. Even Gareth Southgate, the manager of the English national team, has described Guardiola as an innovator who has had an impact at all levels of the English game. No wonder, then, that some might be inclined to assume he had a hand, even an indirect one, in Rochdale's moment of viral fame, a seed he had sown come to full bloom. The reality, though, is a little more complex. Shifting the cultural window. This past summer, Brian Barry Murphy, Rochdale's Irish manager, attended a fans forum. He is 41 and was then on the cusp of his first full season in professional management after a long playing career in England's lower leagues. The premise of such forums is simple. The manager and his staff meet with some of their club's most ardent fans, giving them a chance to explain their ideas, and the fans an opportunity to express their concerns and hopes for the season ahead. One fan stood out to Barry Murphy, the one who had been unimpressed by the club's tendency in recent years to pass the ball around. He told us that what fans wanted was more goal-mouth action, Barry Murphy said, smiling. I told him that was what I wanted too, as long as it was in the right goal-mouth. It's just that we had a different way of getting the ball there. After that goal in Southend, Barry Murphy and Rochdale were hailed as outliers, ambassadors for aestheticism amid the barbarism of League One. In person, it can be easy to buy into the image. Barry Murphy cites Guardiola's Barcelona and Marcelo Bielsa's Athletic Bilbao as his formative influences. But he does not see it like that. There are more and more teams at our level playing possession-based football, he said. There has been a change, no doubt. You did have teams who played that way when I was playing, but there weren't the ideas there are now, and it was very much the exception. There was always a sense of, how dare they play like that? The eyes of those who have toiled in English soccer's foothills for longer than Barry Murphy, some of that change can be attributed to Guardiola. You always look at the best, said Gary Johnson, the much-traveled former manager of Yeovil Town, Bristol City, and Cheltenham, now working in England's fifth tier at Torquay. Recently, Johnson noted how many teams now split their central defenders, with a midfielder dropping in trying to build play from the back, something borrowed directly from Guardiola and his apostles. You try to see what we can emulate at our level, Johnson said, but there are limits to the influence of the elite. What happens at the top does have an impact, said Paul Tisdale, who, like Johnson, has long had a reputation as one of English soccer's unheralded progressives. It shifts the cultural window. It changes the idea of what is acceptable. What it does not change is the reality of life in the lower leagues. Managers can only work with what they have. If players are unable to mimic a style seen in Champions League games, they would be foolish to impose it. Failed experiments quickly lead to a loss of faith, and when that happens, it tends to be the manager that suffers. So either you test the waters gradually, Tisdale said, or you play it safe and don't do it at all. The German model. A few weeks ago, Steve Morrison was preparing Northampton Town's under-18 team for a game against Peterborough. Morrison, a journeyman forward, now taking his first tentative steps in coaching, had watched tapes of his opponent's previous game and had come up with a plan. The way we sold it to the players was that we were going to play like Liverpool, he said. We were going to play with a withdrawn striker in that Roberto Firmino role, press them, win the ball back, and try to catch them quickly in the transition. The players understood what we wanted immediately. Morrison's team won 5-1. When his players returned to the changing room, though, he told them that what had pleased him most, rather than the result, was that he had given them a plan, and they had carried it out perfectly. That, he said, is what they'll need when they go into senior football. Klopp's Liverpool, like Guardiola's Manchester City, is an obvious reference point for teams. It is no coincidence that since he arrived at Anfield, the likes of Huddersfield, Barnsley, Norwich, and Southampton have all appointed German coaches, or those with experience in Germany, cast in his high-pressing image. Just as important as Klopp's playing style, though, is his managerial approach. He's shown that, really, it is about people, Morrison said. A happy player is a good player. You look at his players, and they are happy. By wearing his emotions on his sleeve, Morrison said, Klopp has helped to smash the long-standing image of manager as dictator. And now, ideas he has introduced are bleeding down, just as Guardiola's are, not only through England's leagues, but in its age groups, too. But that is not a cause of English soccer's great cultural leap, say those watching it happen, but a consequence of it. Today, every academy in England is governed by a unified syllabus. The Premier League created Elite Player Performance Plan, which emphasizes technical coaching supported by video presentation and data analysis. Morrison is not necessarily a true believer. I don't see why every player should have the same journey when all of their requirements are different, he said, but that it is a step forward from what came before is not in question. All of the players that you get from the academies now know what you need to do to play out from the back, said Rochdale's Barry Murphy. They have the core skills. Now we have to teach them all of the other elements of playing professionally. The environment has changed too. Tisdale played in the Premier League briefly for Southampton. He recalls facing Aston Villa once on a field so bad that they had painted the sand green so it looked the right color. He added, that has changed now. The pitches are perfect all year round. The refereeing is different too. The thuggery has gone. Guardiola's style can only be adopted and adapted because England's climate is now more receptive to new ideas. England is more accepting of playing proper football, Tisdale said. It has been a gradual change in tone and culture over the last 15 or 20 years. It's not yet complete, of course, as Barry Murphy found at the Rochdale Fan Forum, where there are still those who prioritize goal-mouth action. How it comes about is secondary. So while McClellan, the Rochdale fan, may have despaired at seeing his team abandon its principles against Ipswich, plenty of others would have disagreed. As the clock ticked down, the 3,000 or so inside Rochdale's home ground grumbled whenever a player chose the short pass over the long, or decided to go backward rather than sending an aimless cross into the penalty area. Cultural shifts take time. When the final whistle blew, as Rochdale fans headed into the night, Ipswich's victorious players walked over to their fans. They arranged themselves into a line, grasped each other's hands, and raised them above their heads in celebration. Ipswich's manager, Paul Lambert, played in Germany. Teams communing with their supporters like this is a common sight there. The most high-profile exponent of the tradition in England is Klopp. Like Guardiola, he's helping to change English soccer. But he can only do it because English soccer had changed so much anyway. And now turning to a brief look at college basketball. The headline is, the Fab Five, once again, a big deal in Michigan. Juwan Howard, the new Michigan basketball coach, was musing recently about the state of college basketball when he interrupted himself. Guys are jumping out of the gym. I think they're more athletic. No, let me hold on, Howard said. If I say they're more athletic than how it was when I played, than everyone, all the past players. Oh my God, you say they're more athletic? Well, you couldn't jump. Why waste the time, Howard added. I don't have the energy for it. I'm trying to coach a team. This may become a theme during Howard's first season at the helm. There will be plenty of talk about his past accomplishments as a player, but the former Fab Five standout will be focused on his new challenge. Brought back to Michigan after John Beilein's departure, Howard has to place the winningest coach in the history of the program. While some nostalgia is inevitable, he'll ultimately be judged on whether he can keep the Wolverines moving in the right direction. Whether Juwan Howard, the coach, can lift his team the way Juwan Howard, the player, did. Howard won his opener at Michigan on Tuesday night, 79-71, over Appalachian State. His fellow Fab Fivers, Jalen Rose and Jimmy King, were there to show support. The Wolverines led by 30 in the second half, then let that lead dwindle all the way to 5 in the final minute, presenting Howard with his first near crisis. The team won, but left plenty of room for improvement. The reunion between the Wolverines and Howard means the Fab Five might become a topic during just about any Michigan broadcast, and the new coach can expect support from his old teammates. Jackson said he can't wait to come to games, and King said he has seen the team practice. Although those former players are excited, they're also mindful that this is now Howard's show. "I will probably be the most consistent visitor because I live here," King said. "We have not discussed a date for all five of us to get there because the focus is on Juwan. Everything else is ancillary at this point." And now taking a look at NFL Week 10 by Benjamin Hoffman. Report of Cowboys' demise were exaggerated. Packers and Rodgers look to rebound. The return of Mahomes. What's up with the Rams? The NFL is down to one unbeaten team, the San Francisco 49ers, and you will have to wait until Monday night to see it play. This week's games do not offer a lot of must-see matchups, but viewers should be buoyed considerably by the return of Chiefs quarterback Patrick Mahomes. Here's a look at NFL Week 10 with all picks made against the point spread. Vikings at Cowboys. The point spread is the Cowboys -3. As the Cowboys, 5-3, went through a three-game losing streak, it was easy to wonder if their strong start to the season had been a mirage. Instead, it appears those three losses in which Dallas dealt with injuries on its offensive line were the anomaly. Back at something close to 100%, the Cowboys have rolled to consecutive wins by a combined score of 74-28. Panthers at Packers. The line is the Packers -5. The Packers started the year looking much improved on defense, but their enthusiasm has waned from week to week. They are still allowing fewer points per game than they did last year, but their ranking in terms of total yardage allowed per game has declined from 18th to 26th this year. Last week, those defensive shortcomings were evident as Green Bay was crushed after its offense pulled a disappearing act early on. This week may not be any easier. Green Bay struggles to defend running backs, and the Panthers have the most versatile and productive back in the NFL, Christian McCaffrey, who is on pace to make a serious challenge at Chris Johnson's single-season record for yards from scrimmage, 2,509 set in 2009. That being said, consider this. Aaron Rodgers was embarrassed last week, and he now gets to face a middling defense at home. And taking a quick look at our local product, Ravens at the Bengals, and the line is the Ravens -10. The Ravens beat the previously 8-0 Patriots in Week 9 and will try to keep their concentration up this week when they face the 0-8 Bengals. The contrast is extreme, and while Baltimore found plenty of running room against New England, it's almost scary to think how much could be available against Cincinnati. Sure, opponents have run to chew up the clock against the Bengals, but that's not the only contributor to their league worst 177.6 rushing yards per game allowance. The Ravens' offense has averaged an NFL best 204 per game. It's mismatch made in fantasy football heaven. And that'll do it for today's New York Times Sports Sunday. My name is Chris Blazewski. I wish you a good afternoon.